Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Seneca Podcast, coming to you today from the Fordham Law School in Manhattan. How is everyone doing tonight? Yeah. All right. That's what I am talking about. The Seneca Podcast is, of course, produced in proud partnership with SupChina. SupChina is the best way to keep on top of all the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day through our excellent newsletter, our app, or, of course, straight from the old tap at the website supchina.com. We offer uncensored reporting and commentary on everything from media policy to the Me Too movement, from the latest on the Belt and Road Initiative to Beijing's ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We are sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and joining me on this Valentine's Day, this day of passion and romance, is my alarmingly hirsute date for the evening. He did not have that beard, I assure you, when I swiped right on his picture in Tinder. I swear to God. Anyway, his name...
That's what my wife said, too.
Right, Jeremy Goldcorn, or that's what he says. I looked him up. He's actually better known as El Maíz Dorado, which I believe was his name when he was a professional Mexican wrestler. Anyway, the one and only Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. Give it up.
All I can say is thank you, Kaiser.
All right. You're not going to criticize the corniness of my intro.
Stop now.
Okay. I've got more. I'm at the inexhaustible supply of ridiculous introductions for Jeremy. We are joined this evening by one of my favorite people who's writing on China, Jianying Zha. Zha Jianying writes with great sensitivity, both personal and political sensitivity, about contemporary China and makes it come alive in all its maddening complexity for the readership of The New Yorker, where some of the best writing she's done has appeared. She is the author of some fantastically good books, including China Pop and The Tide Players, which I highly recommend. Jianying, welcome back to Seneca.
Thank you. It's about time.
Yeah.
Indeed. Welcome, Jianying, and welcome back, because those of you who've listened to us for a long time may recall we did a show with Jianying in 2011 in Capital M in Beijing, and it was called The Soul of Beijing.
Yeah, good show. Go back and listen to it. It actually holds up sort of surprisingly well. I listened to it again recently. I'm pleased to report, though, that we have gotten much better at actually doing live recordings that sound decent. So I promise you, when you go back and listen to this show, it'll sound a lot better than that one did. But anyway, do go back and listen to that one. It's a really good show.
So let's get into it. We promised you a show about dealing with troublemakers. Jianying, your December piece from The New Yorker talks about some of the very, shall we say, interesting ways that the Chinese authorities deal with critics. One such critic is, of course, your own brother, Zha Jianguo. And one of the ways that the authorities have dealt with him is something called Bei Luyou, to be touristed or to be vacationed. Can you explain what that means, why it's done, and what is involved?
Get your tones right. It's Bei Luyou.
Bei Luyou. Well, it's one of the Bei on a growing list of the Bei phenomena. Basically, it's a new kind of invention on the Chinese internet to describe this odd phenomena of someone who is framed by usually a law enforcement, a police or official, to be seemingly doing something in order to crack down on this person or round him up. For example, the Bei list, there's something called Bei Hexie is the most common, widespread to be harmonized.
So Bei, right? Bei is a passive indicator, right?
It's a passive
to be the object of some verb. So
Right.
To be.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But sorry, I should explain. Bei in Chinese means to be. It's a passive verb. To put that in front of a whole bunch of nouns or to describe whatever activity that follows this bei is actually
that's done to you.
It's something it's that's done to you. So now
to be touristed.
Exactly. No,
there's another one like
and to be tax evaded.
Oh right. What's that one in Chinese?
Bei漏税. It was like our friends Ai Weiwei and your friend maybe Fan Bingbing.
Oh, not my friend. I wish.
Anyway, there are lots of people. I can't say everyone. There are in fact a lot of tax evasions in China. It's quite rampant. But some characters who were caught in like high profile cases like Fan Bingbing or Ai Weiwei are widely perceived as, being caught not for tax evasion per se, but for other activities. Usually, for example, in the case of Ai Weiwei, for other dissident or critical speeches or that. Right. Yeah. But in fact, the official will arrest this person on tax evasion.
So this is like you said, it's one of a number of them, of these pretty darkly humorous bei constructions. So we have, like you said, bei lu you, of course, and bei lo shui. Also some very dark ones like bei zi sha,
to be suicided,
right?
Yeah.
Which means you're sort of compelled to commit suicide, or in cases where the suicide looks really quite suspicious, like it wasn't actually a suicide, but it's often applied. Whole bunch of them have emerged in this era of stability maintenance.
That's right.
What's the significance of this? Why have there been this interesting parade of these bei constructions?
Yeah, I think this is a very eerie kind of symptom of the police state moving, in fact, to, you might say, a little more sophisticated way of, silencing or get rid of those troublemakers in different spheres, right? Some of them are actually party officials. Others are critics, like, say, the petitioners or NGO activists or, civil rights lawyers. But in the old era, say in the Maoist era or the early, reform era, some of them can be just completely rounded up or arrested in the name of, say, counter-revolutionary activities. So that's pretty straightforward. Just basically, you don't need an excuse that this person somehow outly, broke the law by evading tax, or maybe, he had depression and just decided to commit suicide. But in fact, it was something else. Something shady is happening here. But now, the state seemed to find it necessary to have a kind of excuse that looks like something normal happened. He took a vacation and he had depression, so he took his own life. Or, in some weird, in fact, this particular New Yorker piece, I had to quarrel with the editor to insist this, the bei list, to insist this to be zhonged, to bei piao chang. Because the editor is actually worried that the American readers would not be able to process this. What does it mean to be zhonged? Zhang meaning
the
male.
Maybe we need to explain that. Piaochang means to go out soliciting prostitutes, right?
Yeah.
So to bei piaochang, what does that mean? It means
like you're passively you're framed as if you're caught in the act. But in fact, the whole case might be framed. Like a prostitute may be enlisted to, seduce this guy who's being framed. There are actually some high-profile cases of such.
Xue Manzi is
one of them. Yeah. This is one of the
Charles Xue. Yeah.
Well, in his case, some of these are not,
I don't know how much bei was.
was in that particular case, yeah. But there are other cases.
There was some
cases.
Active verbiage going on there. Somewhere.
Exactly.
Or bei yu mi la.
Okay, yeah, bei yu mi la. And let's, let's change tack a little bit. Before we actually discuss your brother's wonderful holiday with his minders, let's talk a little bit about him and his history of political activism. How did it all start for him?
He's your older brother, right?
He's my older brother. Mm-hmm. He's actually my half-brother from my father's first marriage. So he's old Red Guard, a kind of a Cultural Revolution radical that went to the countryside in the late 60s and 70s. Spent actually 20 years there until he came back just on the eve of Tiananmen. So as a dissident or a troublemaker, in fact, he's a very latecomer. Only in the 90s, he began to hook up with some of these other dissidents in Beijing. One of them is Xu Wenli, who's a veteran who already was jailed for many years and was released and was thinking about forming an opposition party. And they, along with dozens of others in different parts of China, began to agitate for this democracy party, Zhongguo Minzhudang. Right on the eve of actually Bill Clinton was visiting China. This gave them an unexpected short window of, you know, not being immediately cracked down. So they, in fact, actually went to register this party in different parts of China. But as soon as Clinton left, they were all rounded up. So, you know, most of the leaders were sentenced the charges of subversion of state for up to like a decade. Like my brother was sentenced to 9 years, and there were people who were sentenced to like 12, 13 years in jail. So the party basically was crushed within 6 months. But this was the beginning of my brother's career as a troublemaker. In fact, that was the title of my earlier New Yorker piece, but the editor, you know, on publication, they give it a different title, Enemy of the State.
Right. Well, the original was Troublemaker.
That was my own title.
Yeah. So how would you describe your brother's worldview then? What is it that he believes? What is it that he wants? And how did he come into it? And if you had to break it down into constituent parts, how much of it would you assess to be sort of honest commitment to democratic values and institutions? How much of it is just sort of anti-authoritarianism, maybe an outgrowth of that same kind of anti-authoritarian impulse that led him to become a Red Guard? How much of it is just sort of an irrepressible gadfly instinct, because he is quite an irrepressible gadfly. He won't stop, right? Mm-hmm. Which is really, really interesting. And, you know, just sort of his plain old stubbornness. I mean, I feel like, let's put him on the couch for a second and tell me what are the constituent parts of his
psychology? All of above. I mean, everything you just said earlier was part of the makeup of someone like my brother, who was a complete diehard, you know, rebel from very early on. I actually wrote in that early profile of him about how from childhood he was was already revealing this unruliness against the authoritarian teachers, say, in very elite high school in Beijing. That was even before the Cultural Revolution started. So, but then he's someone who kind of embraced a cause. He had to have a cause. He basically became a radical Maoist in the sense that he answered Mao's call to go to the countryside, spread the revolution, be with the peasant, and he would follow that until he hit a hard wall, right?
Wow.
So, of course, at the end of 20 years, he didn't change the peasants, the peasants changed him. I mean, I literally remember visiting him in Inner Mongolia in a little backwater town back then, and seeing in front of my eyes this you know, high school bright student from an elite Beijing high school 20 years later. I couldn't tell him apart from any of those local, you know, peasants who would be squatting there in by the train station selling eggs or potatoes. He was just one of them.
Wow.
That was, you know, that phase. But then I think his next phase is he finally got totally disillusioned with all that after Tiananmen. And he realized, you know, this was the wrong utopian or revolution that he was engaged on. So he made a total turnaround and decided basically democracy is the new cause. And the root of all, you know, problems in China was called the Communist Party. I think, you know, that was, I mean, I'm maybe reducing his since then, I think he's become quite, I really was quite impressed by, he's a very good student of new things since he's been in jail for 9 years. He's read a ton of books, and since his release, he's caught up with the new media. He's, you know, sort of, I think, become, this is maybe an oxymoron, but he's like a moderate among the radicals.
Oh, interesting.
So among that diehard small community of dissidents, I think he's emerged more and more as a firm but a moderate voice.
How did you see him, you know, go into the sort of more moderate stance? What was it that he, were there any kind of the inflection points in that development?
It happened, I think, over the, you know, the last maybe 10 years or so, when I think he realized this is a long haul. It's right. not going to, the revolution is not going to happen. Not going to be mass uprising just because, you know, people realize, you know, this is the wrong system. So we're going to just, you know, pay, everybody will be on the street and have a new revolution. That's not going to happen. Though he would be one of those forever telling you, never say never.
Right.
Things are not predictable. So don't rule that out. But that's not what you operate from.
So how about you and the rest of your family? I mean, as you watched your brother, you know, develop or get in trouble or whatever you like to call his activities of the last 20 years, were you worried about him? Did you try and dissuade him from doing it? Were you worried it might affect you and your other families, your other family members?
I have to say, you know, as a little sister, I kind of admired him as a hero from a childhood on. So I never, I mean, this is, even though we didn't quite grow up together because he went to the boarding school and then he went to Inner Mongolia and just sort of disappeared, right, for 20 years. But we have always had a sort of a bond. Maybe we had always things in common to talk to. So I sort of followed his, if you say, transformation or intellectual journey enough to know, and I also know him as this character. I mean, he's long told me this is my fate, and this is what he told me basically the first time I visited him in jail. He said, I knew I was going to get here, and I never tried to dissuade him from what he does. I know he would follow it he basically, to this day, he would say, you know, he's prepared to go back to jail anytime for any length of the time. And he's basically prepared to die in jail if it comes to that. So, and when I wrote about, in a sentimental way, a hero, he's actually a flawed character. He's a human, you know, he's a disastrous businessman, for example, before he actually turned, you know, after he came back to the city, you know. He had a lot of things, and certain radicalist part of him, we quarreled, and we didn't quite really, was not always on the same wavelengths. But I understood him enough to know that's the meaning of his life. This
so
is his
there's
cause.
No point in
there's
trying.
No point. No, I don't think I ever tried to say, no, this is not what you should be doing. Basically, my role is to just try to understand him, give him whatever form of support I could. But there's plenty of other members in our Jia family. There's a large clan. There, his own mother, other sister, their relatives, cousins. There are a lot of people who try to talk him out of it. Basically pleading on the cause of, you know, both to think for the rest of the family, for others, or that this is a hopeless, you know, this is a hopeless cause. You're just on a suicidal, you know, mission. So there's plenty of people who are doing that, right?
But okay, so another sort of related issue. Do you ever worry that your writing, particularly your writing about him, will get him into more trouble in China?
I thought about that. From very early on, the two main pieces I wrote about him, one was when he was still in jail. And I thought there's no place worse that, you know, anything could get him. This, what, as a writer, the only thing I can do, I can't do what he does, you know, and I don't intend to do what he does, but I can write about a character like him. And I feel that is almost my mission, if I have one, to tell stories like that, that would give me a kind of a meaning, maybe in certain space. Because at that point, even though he was spending, you know, 9 years in jail, no one knew who he was. I mean, that party was little known. Because he was crushed so utterly, so swiftly, and none of the Chinese media in China reported about any of this. And because he's a latecomer, he's not like someone like Wei Jingsheng, who had earlier had an episode when China was, you know, still relatively open. People knew about him. So he was in total obscure, you know, person doing this thing in this tiny cell, right? So I thought the only thing I could do is to tell his story. And but then this more recently, this about the police state with him again as, you know, the main character in it. Again, I thought about whether this is going to get him in more trouble, and I didn't think so. But still, I made, you know, the one point I did insist was not to have the famous New Yorker fact checkers to call him beforehand, because I know all his phones and everything was tapped and monitored. And so I didn't tell him I was writing this. So he didn't see it even after it came out. And only after it was translated into Chinese and began to circulate on WeChat that he read it in one of the groups. So he said, like, "Ha, you know, I saw this." So I said, "Oh, you know, sorry, I'm just playing a little innocent joke on you. You know, I knew you would find out, but I wanted to
innocent 8,000 word joke."
Right. So I think this is maybe the first time he actually is a little worried about me, whether this would give me any trouble traveling back, you know, back and forth.
So he was actually released in, what, 07, is that right?
08.
Oh, 08, yeah. Right. And just in time to sign Charter 08. Right? He actually was a signatory on Charter 08, which is interesting. Because what I think is fascinating is that, so he emerged from jail in 2008, and we, you know, you just mentioned WeChat, mm-hmm. and now he's active in these WeChat circles. He emerged into a whole new world of social media, mm-hmm. of a blooming public sphere, beginning with, you know, the BBSs, these, you know, online internet forums, and then graduating into Weibo. And mm-hmm. he's been very active on all of these things. He has some room, apparently, to express his dissident political ideas. Mm-hmm. It's very clearly circumscribed, mm-hmm. but he does have some room. Can you talk about the room that he has had and what he's done with that room? He has apparently been completely unapologetic. He's just continued to push to the limits, right? Yeah. So it's interesting because he does seem to delineate what the limits are by what he can he can do, right?
Right, yeah. So, I mean, in fact, you know, this new media, actually, we're talking about the new media, but before that, there was still the traditional media, right? The newspapers from the after recovering from the initial kind of complete, you know, shock of Tiananmen, had in fact through the early 90s, when the market reform was going ahead, was deliberately, you know, a lot of the intellectual journalists' energies were channeled into a relatively liberal media in many forms. In these, you think about these newspaper group, the weekend editions that loosen up, you know, that was
and stuff like that.
Yeah, Lingdian. There's a whole range of them, and so I think in that phase there's a lot of liberal journalists and reporters who, you know, seize that moment and try to, you know, write in a more relatively, I mean, censorship was always around. But, you know, in that space, I think a lot of liberal people were having a platform to spread their message and to push for a kind of political reform or freedom in general, or there's a cultural, you know, more cultural spaces that are not official. That, I mean, you're part of that. I mean, you're in Beijing, there's, you know, rock, you know, there were rock groups, jazz groups, there were all these, and there's these salon types. My brother, though, did not come to all that until, I would say, like, he had to recover from, you know, not being around for 9 years in jail, right? So after, I think, maybe 2010, it was maybe about the time he began to write these blog pieces. And he's, of course, is strictly in this kind of political commentary form. So, and given he's really uncompromisingly, you know, critical stance and views, that, of course, could only be circulated in this space where, you know, there are pockets of more, you know, on the internet that can air such pieces and views. You're not talking about main spaces like right. portals, like in
it's in the comments to pieces, and it's
yeah,
in,
and then right. it gets reposted, it gets onto appear in some overseas Chinese websites, and then it gets circulated back. So it's this whole kind of combination of, you know, channels and free
it's
and
a liminal
semi-free.
Space, though, yeah.
Yeah. yeah,
it's really just the leakiness of the surveillance and policing systems. Do you think that is allowing the space to exist? It's not out of design.
Well, they've even cracked down on that, though, right? I mean, yeah. in recent years, it's gotten much harder for him to be...
Much harder, yeah. increasingly harder. Even though, you know, from the beginning, someone like him was banned from publishing anything in official, you know, media, right? But they know what people like him are doing and publishing, and they basically allowed that space to, you know, to carry on.
Well, are you talking about the golden liberal era of Hu Jintao and Wen Dabao?
That we so fondly remember.
We laugh, but it's true. I mean, but now, of course, we're all on the kind of receiving end of some, I think, irony of harboring that kind of...
Nostalgia for those days.
Yeah,
maybe.
Well, because we're all on the pointy end, right.
Yeah.
So, if I may ask, Jian Guo is apparently determined to stay in China and Jian Guo. He doesn't want to come to the United States and join his daughters or you, and he basically thinks that China is where he should be. Can you explain his thinking about this? Is it that, like some dissidents say, if you go into exile, you become irrelevant and... You know, you are unable to do anything positive about China anyway, or what is his thinking?
Yeah, that is a big fear. You know, I mean, to this day, I think a lot of Chinese exiles, I still feel the loss of this sort of mother language, home space, where they could be doing, in my brother's language, would be, you know, fighting the battle on the front, you know, front line. You have to be where, you know, the battle is, right? If you're cut off from that, you know, then you have no voice, you have no space, and they're not the kind of, especially people of his generation, they don't feel they can actually cross over to a different language and culture and still have a meaningful kind of existence. So China is what they hung on to. And I think some of the earlier exiles who were forced out still, you know, where I know some of them in New York, for example.
Sure.
You know, you feel this forever kind of nostalgia or bitterness about being an exile. And we see this in exiles everywhere. You know, if you read Herzen's, you know, that big book on my past, my thoughts, I think that all that, early Russian exiles, even though they were culturally and linguistically actually much better positioned in Europe, they're all like multilingual and all that. And once they left Russia, you know, they feel like they're cut off.
Right.
And I think part of that is my brother's, you know, feeling that he doesn't want to leave. Even if he stays in jail, and in some ways, some people who now see China as a giant jail,
right.
you know, if you're doing that kind of thing, basically you have very limited space to operate, but still they want to be there.
Well, the other thing about going into exile is that you see what happens to them. They all fall to squabbling with one another.
Factionalism.
Terrible factionalism. I mean, is he aware of that? And how do you diagnose that? Why does that happen? Why do you suppose it is that these
people... most vicious fighting is amongst Chinese dissidents
right.
in New York.
I mean, it's terrible, the things they say about each other, right?
Yeah.
Why do you suppose that happens?
Well, I mean, I think it's easy for me to kind of lapse into the usual kind of lament about this is part of the byproduct of, you know, a totalitarian kind of culture, totalitarian politics. In fact, you know, you're the mirror image of your enemies.
Exactly.
So in fact, you know, as soon as it doesn't mean that, you know, you're fighting your enemy, you become something else. You may be still the same animal, you know, so you turn around and started fighting within yourselves, and you see spies around you, and you begin to see in the same way, in the same black and white white way, like the your enemy, which is the Communist Party.
The same authoritarian habits of mind.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And the same hierarchy, the same suspicion, right. all that purge that happened in China. I mean, in fact, this is not particularly Chinese either.
I've had that conversation with a lot of people, and one of the more persuasive suggestions that I've heard is that the kind of people who take up political dissident activism in China, it takes a certain personality type. They're going to be exceptionally brave, for one thing. They're also going to be egotistical. They're going to be extreme individualists. They're going to be megalomaniacal in some cases.
They're going to be monolithical. They're going to be sexist in many ways. And recently I've discovered sexist? Among some of my longtime, I don't know, I used to think of them as liberals. Now I think maybe they need a different hat or label, you know, who are... they're sexy. Some of them are now in the like more recent phenomenon. Say some of them have really a lot of trouble with Me Too, the movement, which it had a kind of a short play in China. I mean, it's not ending. But it started there too. And some of my, you know, I thought liberal Chinese friends had trouble with that. And there's lots of people who have trouble with the Islamic culture. But, you know, some of them, I mean, this is, I think, you know, underneath these views, I mean, what's underneath the sort of Chinese, let's see, this is another maybe oxymoron, Chinese liberal Trump fans. Is there such a thing?
Liberal Trump fans.
I've discovered since the since this last U.S. election, a lot of my Chinese liberal friends, because in Chinese, these labels are all needs
in
further
the mirror.
Explanation.
I mean, it's the mirror image, like the right in China.
They're defined as, you know, to the party. The Communist Party started as the ultra-left.
Right.
So anybody who's against the party is basically actually on the right. If you think about the 1957 anti-rightist campaign, right, these are the newer generation of that rightists in China. But in the sort of usual political spectrum of talking about Chinese politics, they're all lumped together as 自由派, which means liberals, right?
You see the same phenomenon in Eastern Europe. A lot of Czech or Polish, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. liberals are actually quite enamored with these kind of Trumpian authoritarian characters. It's very unfortunate.
Let us turn now to the vacation that your brother was forced to take. The series of guided tours that your brother was forced to take. Can you, you know, set the scene for us?
Well, you know, for those who haven't read the piece, I basically, tracked from, I think, 2012 is where he put in particular. I don't know whether there are other Bei Liuyou before that year, but he's definitely started around 2012 and increased with frequency. I think back then, maybe it's once or twice a year on these so-called sensitive days, which means like anniversary of Tiananmen.
The calendar is filled with sensitive days.
Right? It's like the birthday, right? Every day is on birthday now. But anyway, so back then there were just these certain like anniversaries or party congress. But now, you know, because China has emerged, you know, into this global kind of powerhouse, so all kinds of global forums that's held in Beijing or in Qingdao or in Shanghai also become sensitive days. And so on such occasions, the police would usually take certain, you know, a selective numbers of troublemakers out of the sight of that city, wherever that forum or party congress is happening. Take them out of the city on these beautiful locations, say a beach resort or the northwestern, if it's the summer, maybe to the northeast for usually a week, or in the case of my brother, sometimes it could be 2 weeks.
Wow. All expenses paid,
and usually with his handlers, doing everything, taking everything, booking the tickets, hotels, and take him everywhere on site, including snapshots of him on these, scenic spots. So, I think the rationale, of course, is to maintain security and a perfect city so that no troublemakers will raise hell by talking to foreign media, complaining about Chinese politics, or some of these, particularly loud, petitioners might go on the street or get themselves in front of Tiananmen and all of a sudden show up with a placard or whatever. So you take them out, right, and treat them really nicely, but make sure their cell phones is in your possession, or they can't. They have no access to anything.
So no internet.
Media.
No internet.
No internet. Yeah. But another side of this.
I could use one of those holidays.
Jeremy, I think you qualify as a troublemaker, and you could easily, were you to go back to Beijing, I think they would happily take you on such a holiday.
I also think whoever come up with this idea must be a brilliant, entrepreneur.
It's genius.
Yeah, it's totally business. I almost thought, maybe Harvard Business School could write a case story about this. This is
innovation with the Public Security Bureau.
Yeah.
Not the public.
Like really weirdly Kafkaesque. I mean, is that the right? Yeah. I mean, it is.
It's kind of midway between Kafka and Huxley.
Yeah, Huxley, right. There's also
Orwellian Brave New World.
Into submission.
And it's a long food chain because it's in the interest of these police to have these troublemakers, right? So that would be their reason to have a free vacation. So you would see this phenomena in Beijing, but also in different provincial cities, sometimes with the excuse, even though the conference or the forum is actually happening elsewhere, but the local police could use that to get some of their local characters. They would want to escort them,
right.
Their local troublemakers on vacation.
Right. Yeah, you get a vacation too. So... yeah, there's a real incentive to do this. Wasn't it the case that they would carry his luggage for him? They were incredibly solicitous, right?
Yeah,
They would make sure to see to all his comforts. He was eating lavishly and
they were eating.
Drinking.
Well, I don't know how lavish because I'm not sure their budget would allow 5-star hotels. Say,
but they're
very well treated, and he's definitely. Treated almost, instead of being their hostage, he's like their patron. And the particularly dark comedy part of this is, they often get lumped together. They're mistaken by other real tourists on these tours because sometimes the police book their group, say my brother and his three agents, right? They're all in plain clothes. So nobody, of course, could tell this is a Beiliu. They look like real tourists. So sometimes on these tours, they get on the same bus, visiting the same sites with the real tourists. And the real tourists sometimes, how gossipy and nosy Chinese, and you're bored on these buses. So who are these two people? They're all male and they always hung together. They're inseparable. And it's very easy to guess, my brother usually being the older one, and everybody's serving him.
What do they
even
think
on
they
the
are,
meal tables?
He's their boss? Or?
They would guess, is this the 是你的老板? is he your boss? Or what's your relationship? Are you uncles? And is this your family vacation? And they would show him such deference. It seems like such a respect, right, at the meal table. They would... get a tianfan, scoop out more rice and soup and this and that. So he's being treated as if he's the boss. So this is really, I don't know if it's Kafka. Maybe
I think you need to write a new, this needs to be Jai-esque, perhaps. You have to write a new novel.
Right.
So when he was when he was arrested in 2017, in your piece, it's a pretty funny tableau with him sitting in a massage parlor getting a herbal facial when the cops bust down the door, more or less, to come and get him. That arrest was actually for something that he'd written that, in a Chinese context, is pretty incendiary, I would say.
Yes.
I mean, he stopped short of calling for a military coup, but, that was the feeling of the piece.
Right.
What was your reaction when you saw what he'd written?
I was actually traveling in Hubei when I saw that he wrote this new blog. I didn't pay attention to it because I was traveling. But then when I got to Beijing, I first heard from a professor, this guy, Beida professor, Zhang Qianfan. He just sent me, he said, I heard your brother is taken away. And I didn't even get super alarmed because he's such a veteran with police. It's just 家常便饭, you know, it's like every day police follow him. And this was right a few days before Tiananmen anniversary. So I thought, oh, nothing out unusual. Then I realized this is different because he was taken away and he was put in an unknown detention site for interrogation for that one WeChat piece, which he was accused of. I mean, he wasn't accused, he was really written like that, you know, like a roadmap in
for
case
a
of
a coup,
yeah,
right.
In case of a mass, you know, an unexpected incident leads into a military coup. What he actually meant was that there's always a chance when unexpected mass incidents happens on a sensitive time, given the pent up discontent, the military might not follow the order, might disobey the order to open fire. So this could be different from 1989. So that was basically his scenario. But the mention of a military coup leading to, I mean, there's a whole scenario after that of changing government, changing regime and all that, just spooked somehow the police and the censors about this. So, and he, of course, his piece gets reposted to a lot of groups. So they basically had to stop this. And they were threatening him and trying to make him pledge not to write anything like this.
But they were bending over backward to give him like, oh, I think you might have meant this, right?
Yeah.
And he would say, no, I really meant this. Oh, but maybe we misinterpreted it as this.
Yes.
I mean, giving him all these outs.
Yeah.
Right?
Always the agent in the course of this long interrogation first tried to say, look, you didn't really repost, you didn't send it to a lot of groups, right? So meaning, you know, this
oh,
is
yes, I
maybe
did.
Not a lot of you. He said, no, absolutely, yes. I said. So maybe you copied this from someone else. Maybe you are not the author. He said, no, I absolutely 100% sure. So they were after this, they were trying, and they were very polite to him. They call him in this very, you know, reverential term. Jia Lao means, you know,
the elder Jia.
And they said, so they finally said, God, we were already chided by our leaders to be too soft on you, and now you're calling for a military coup. You know, you're putting us in such an impossible situation. But all the time, they still didn't lose their. So in fact, the way to read that situation is not just they're acting this way through sheer humanity, because I think they also wanted this whole case to be seen as not so out of hand, maybe not stirring up wider circles, so they're not going to be blamed. The police themselves are not going to be heavily blamed.
They're part
blamed.
Of the crime, in other
yeah,
words.
Exactly.
So they want to minimize the crime.
Exactly. To control the damage that
right.
way. Yeah.
Jing, you talk about your own crowd of generally wealthy, pretty sophisticated urban friends in Beijing, your circle of people. These are, let me quote from your story. You wrote, the people I'm friends with in Beijing, you call them, but you write of them, yet many Chinese liberals doubt that the Western system is feasible in their country. They fret about the burden of history, about the prospect of chaos and mob rule. In their own lives, they avoid radicals and former political prisoners for fear that such associations might jeopardize their personal freedom. They shun the sort of political action that could put their comfortable lifestyle at risk. I've often urged people that they ought to try to understand these types of people. People I would describe as being this, you know, maybe the center of gravity, really, among educated elites in China. I suspect that there's this imputation here in the U.S. of a kind of moral cowardice to these people with the attitudes that you describe. Maybe I've just spent too much time in the company of just such people, but I feel like I can really quite empathize with them.
Yeah, I think we all spend maybe a lot of time with that people.
I
would
a
say
lot of
then,
them. That's
yeah,
most of
this is a much, much, much bigger block of, you know, under this cap, what I describe as moderate liberals in China. They're basically what usually in the West media, they're called the new middle class. And so in urban, they're a lot of them are in cities. A lot of them are educated. A lot of them have traveled
internationally.
Yeah. And a lot of them have studied abroad, or they have children now studied abroad. And they've done well in the last, 30 years or so of reform. But in terms of ideas, in terms of their sympathies, intellectual sympathies, they are actually with the democracy. And I mean, they feel this is the way to go. However, one, maybe they know too much about Chinese history, and they feel the Chinese history casts such a long shadow. In fact, they're part of that shadow too. You know, that there's a reluctant to believe that this system could change fundamentally. It could follow the Western model in the Chinese context. You know, they would think that a better way to go is gradual reform, incremental change, rather than the kind of wholesale change or radical change people like my brother are advocating.
What does your brother think of people like that?
I think we've talked many times about, they being a tiny minority versus this larger, educated class who, don't see it that way. And are they cowards? Yes and no. I mean, you can't just say, no, they're heroic. No, they're not. I don't think so. I mean, myself included. I picked a different route. Let's just face it. I'm not willing to be a hero in the sense of my brother, of going to jail for this kind of belief. But do I share the same belief and this is the way China should go? Yes, absolutely. But I think my brother has always expressed an understanding about most people would see the way China changed in that light and not in his light.
Right.
So it's not, he would actually be the last person to say those are cowards and they should be, morally, judged.
I feel like here in the U.S., when we think of a Chinese intellectual, when we look at the New York Times and we see another op-ed written by a Chinese intellectual, who is it? It's always Yuhua. It's always Mu Rongxuecun. It's always
Liao Yiwu.
Yeah. People whose views are very comfortable for Westerners.
Right. But, that are quite... But we don't spend much time trying to understand this larger group. And we really kind of dismiss them as, people who are sort of morally cowardly in some way. And I think that's really unfortunate. I think that is a big difference. So, I mean, the people who do get these people and empathize with the choices that they made just based on their own understanding of Chinese history, right?
Yeah, and I also you there's a, this crowd is not all of one piece. I mean, there are different gradations of engagement or choices. Some would not be willing to do what people like my brother, that's the ultimate opposition, to organize the opposition, right? By forming a party, by direct assault on the system, on the party state. But there are all these other, you might call public intellectuals or bloggers, who are very critical, but write in a, you might say, in a more moderate or artful language, or engage in different issues, maybe not frontal organizational kind of politics, but they might be talking about how to reform the education, how to educate the rural areas, the push for NGO activities, broaden using the art, foster artistic freedom as a way to go forward. All of them are making contributions, in fact, to the same cause in different ways. Of course,
I interrupt and say this group of people then, I mean, if we can call them liberal...
Moderate liberals.
who are actually trying to do something. I mean, there's a chill in China right now among this group of people. What's your sense of how they're reacting? And if we had to take a timeline, because, I mean, I think we're all pretty clear that Xi Jinping is a big part of why there is so much repression of free speech and any kind of dissident activities in China. But it started a little earlier. Can you track a timeline? At what point did you notice perhaps some of your more liberal friends perhaps blogging less or not at all, or, you know, not being so forthright in their public statements.
Because that's definitely a thing, right?
I think even as Xi Jinping took over the party leadership, you know, that's 2012, there's still a good chunk of this moderate liberals who still had hope that maybe, you know, what has gradually been, you know, there are incremental changes, and there are even moments where you feel, oh, free speech was getting like a lot of play, you know. Then there are people who are saying, you know, these liberal intellectuals and journalists are taking over the media. You know, I mean, that's an exaggeration, but you get the mood.
2003, 2004, and 2011.
Yeah, about like 2012 with, you know, the constitutionalism movement. I mean,
yeah, 2012.
That's the year when Xi Jinping took over and spoke this language of 依法治国, you know, like we'll do rule of law and put power into the cage. All that give, you know, this really, you know, optimistic feeling for, I would say, at least a year, the first year. But, you know, I mean, we talked earlier about there are people who saw the writing on the wall.
Right. Yeah, like, one of those we were talking about.
Jeremy Barmet, for example.
Who, I mean, and I think 2010, when we first kind of knew that Xi Jinping was going to, I mean, it was already the talk of Beijing, and Xi Jinping was the guy.
Well, we knew in 07, but...
07, I mean, some even earlier. I mean, I worked with his niece in like 2000.
I knew her.
Whose niece?
You?
Xi Jinping's niece.
Oh,
I worked with her in 2002. And... you know, at that time, there was already this incredible aura around. Everybody knew he was
He's
going places.
He's the anointed one.
But I think a lot of people.
But yeah, Jeremy Barmet was one of those who way, way early on basically said, this guy is wants to remake China. He wants to surpass Mao. You know.
Yeah. I think, I mean, I met Jeremy last year talking about being myself, putting myself in the doghouse, because he was asking me, why are you not writing this, you know, what I said, I feel I need to, you know, some period of rethinking, being one of the hopefuls for so long, you know, I would put myself in one of the hopeful for graduate reform camp, cautiously hoping things could go on.
I can imagine what nastily cynical thing Jeremy said in response to that.
I know, and Jeremy is the bad boy of China studies, right? Forever. But so he basically was saying, you know, that this was inevitable in a way from Tiananmen on, maybe, you know, maybe even
nonsense,
earlier from
nonsense,
when but there's a, you know, there's I would say, yes, all of us need, in retrospect, people like Jeremy is right. Turns out to be right. Yeah, this is bad news
for
when
the wrong
Xi Jinping
reasons,
came in.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but I would say, too, aside from some soul probing, I would not regret one point is that I don't quite buy that everything is inevitable.
Right.
As long as it's a Communist Party, things will just hopelessly, Ehrenhausers. So, you know, there's someone named Gorbachev that happened under a Communist Party, too. We can split hairs about the difference between Soviet Union and China, but basically it's the same. It's two brothers in the same, you know, party state system. So there's always, you know, you can't say, even though I'm not saying Xi Jinping obviously was the creature of the system. He did not create all this, okay? The system created him. But there's always unpredictability of, you know, an accident that could be, say, Bo Xilai or Li Keqiang became the number two. Things
the
would not be totally different. Number one, it would not be totally, it would still be the Communist Party. It
but
would
if
still
Bo Xilai was top dog, we would, it'd be so
it
much more fun.
It would be a different.
More fun, yeah.
Well, it's a little more urban
in the sense
than
of interesting
country.
Times
yeah,
fun. But.
Yeah.
No,
but,
no, it would have been really more fun.
Yeah. Also, I think, you know, people engaged in China fighting for whatever through education or art or, you know, pushing the envelope of, you know, free expression, that hope was important for them to have that hope to feel these work are meaningful. And I'm not ready to say it's all down in the tubes.
So you haven't given up hope yet?
Not that kind of hope. Because, right. I mean, it's not like, oh, everything we did in the last 20 years was for naught. Because I think people, if you look at Chinese society, you know, right now, it does, I mean, let me tell you, it's pretty gloomy, especially among the intellectuals or the educated middle, even among the moderate liberals we're talking about.
Yeah, I think the end of term limits really was one of those inflection points where people really freaked out.
I was actually in Beijing when that happened.
Right, and it changed everything. Right?
Some of the people who saw, I have to say, myself included, before that, we've been talking for at least 2 years that this is going to happen. However, when the other shoe actually dropped, all the jaw fell. I mean, everybody was flabbergasted for a moment that this actually happened and pulled through without opposition.
I hate
seemingly.
It when Yumi's right. But
I was one of those, and partly because of Jeremy Barme's influence, who predicted, I think, in 2012 that he was going to try and hang on to power for life.
Yeah.
And I felt, still, it actually happened.
And you were still kind of shocked.
Yeah. I mean, even just the term limit thing was basically predicted for at least 2 years.
Yeah.
People say, oh, this is going to happen. And it happened. And still, everybody realizes this is a watershed event. I was in Beijing. I realized, you know, I remember that, and it's both the Chinese intellectual and the whole West. I remember the Economist cover article right after that is the cover line was how the West got China wrong. Right. And this was the first editorial after the term limit was stripped. And you could see this is a major wake up call.
Well, I had some problems with that piece anyway. So we have some time left, but I want to talk to you about one thing that it's really important to me. I'm somebody who's long believed that the way to understand, that one of the primary engines of Chinese history is the relationship between intellectuals and the state, whether it's the imperial state or the present party state. Understanding the relationship between intellectuals and the state is crucial to understanding how politics moves, how history moves in China. I was in Beijing during the spring of 1989 in Tiananmen when we were there, and I saw a lot of the events unfold from within the square. And I was always struck by one thing. I watched things happen. I talked to a lot of people. I thought I sort of understood what was going on. But, you know, with my sort of kitchen level Chinese back then, I realized that there was this whole level of discourse that was happening that I was not privy to. There was this whole sort of semiotics, this very highly historically conditioned, very symbolic language in the actions, in some of the way that remonstrance was done. And I started to realized it's sort of like watching Peking opera and not knowing that general on stage with all the flags on his back is supposed to be leading an army, or that the guy with that tassel the stick with the tassels on was riding a horse, and not understanding the symbolism. And I realized there was this whole layer underneath it that I didn't get. And so I spent many years afterward trying to understand that. And I think I came to a much better understanding, but I still think it's imperfect at all. I feel like your writings on China really help people to understand the way that the state relates to critical intellectuals, to the kind of mainstream intellectuals that we're talking about. First of all, I guess, do you agree that's an important thing? Do you believe that there's something unique to China about the role that intellectuals play in the political life of the country? And do you think that that's something that isn't well understood outside of China?
In the China study circles or observers, everybody know that the tradition of shi, which is the traditional word for intellectual, right? That through the Confucius tradition and all this, the state exams, you know, basically the intellectuals play a very particular role, an important role of advising the emperor, and now the leaders, right, about the direction of a country, or they also are seen as a spokesperson for
the common people.
So they champion the common people. So they're given a special kind of status or platform to either govern or change the society. So that is why right now this whole ruthless crackdown on the intellectuals by stripping, removing basically a lot of these platforms for their voices are so
disturbing to them,
right? And, you know, cast such a chilling effect because they lost that platform. And so if you go to Beijing now, I mean, I feel I was in there for half a year last year through all that term limit, and I saw all these, you know, private dinners where people like, you know, kvetching or stunned and drink, you know, all these drink parties, and there are lots of people who just feel like despair, a sense of feeling of despair, and
defection.
And they're
defecting from, they were a loyal opposition, right?
They saw themselves as a loyal opposition or a loyal advisor or some a part of the reformed force that's also connected with the system, because there are people, such people in the government too. We're not talking about professors and journalists. And that platform is suddenly pulled from under.
They had these channels of consultation, and suddenly they're just plugging their ears, not listening to them.
And then not only that, it's replaced by this, you know, stodgy, you know, mass, you know, kind of sounding Maoist-like ideological indoctrinations, and all the political, you know, this old molded, people thought that that was already buried in the dustpan of history, even in China. Now they're just like dusted off and came back to the classroom.
And put it on a mobile phone so you can then monitor.
in the classrooms and all this. So I think the intellectuals are now the liberals part of them, because some of them are just now become the spokesperson for the new party state. Or there are lots of that types too. Or, you know, thinking they're riding with this rising global power that's called the new era of China, right? The Xin Shidai, right? But then the others are just doing this familiar. This is not the first time that happened to this class of people. Retreat to their study or to their banquet rooms, to their drinking and you know, doing scholarship. And I'm not saying everybody give up, but everybody senses this is a winter and you don't know how long it's going to last. So, of course, being intellectuals, some of them are doing what they're best at, which is they think, oh, maybe this is the time to write my big book. Right,
but
maybe for the future.
Like, so none of them have a stomach for the fight. None of them are going to join Zai Jianguo on the streets.
Even my brother is not quite on the street anymore. There are new activists by younger people, but not of the same brand. For example, there are these Marxist, you know, students from Beida. Mm. They're joining the labor, you know, the labor forces in Shenzhen.
Right.
They're also immediately get shut. So anything organized, resistance or opposition, have very limited space or lifespan. So, and everybody see that. So right now, I think, you know, there's just this shocked, you know, effect of people being silenced, you know, and lost their language and, you know, retreating to their private space.
So go back to the days of
literature for the drawer.
For the drawer. So you write it and you put it in your drawer and you never show it to anyone.
Yeah, or the other expression, these like we mentioned, these Trump supporters. Mm. I think the despair drive them to this.
Just write, just Chou Wenxuan is a better choice.
The irony is so loud.
I was hoping
you were
going to steer this so we could end on some kind of a
happy note.
A slightly happier note.
I think
that's
the wrong podcast for a happy note.
The sign of despair is because they feel only through an external force.
Right.
Maybe that could pressure things to open. So they would lodge even their hope on a strongman or a liberal, you know, figure from abroad. At least, you know, it takes a bigger hooligan to fight a smaller hooligan. Before U.S. become too weakened, you might as well have, you know, a real Liu Mang, right? This is
the Liu Mang in chief.
Well, he is. I will give him that credit. He is a big fucking Liu Mang. I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to swear. I did mean to swear. Okay, now, but We actually were running a little long.
Sorry, everyone. We could actually stay here all evening.
We could. I mean, lots more. I'm casting about for a way to end more happy. But why don't we do this instead and just move on to recommendations? And yeah, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, my God.
Oh, you still haven't got a recommendation.
Went back. You'll think of one. Because we'll let Jeremy go first. So before we get to recommendations, I do want to remind everybody that the Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina. And if you like what we're doing, the best thing that you can do to support our work is to subscribe to SubChina Access, which gets you all sorts of goodies like the full daily newsletter, discounts to our events. Those of you who are Access members came here free tonight and saved $20. It gets you all sorts of goodies. You can harangue our editorial staff on our Slack channel. That is really fun. Like Lucas here. Give him all sorts of. Anyway, I want to make sure also that you all subscribe to the latest member of the Seneca Network, which is a terrific new podcast called Middle Earth, the Middle Earth Podcast, which is about the culture industry in China. The first episode is about how to become a Wang Hong, how to become an internet famous. I'm famous, a famous person in China. It's check it out. It's a lot of fun. You'll love it. On to recommendations, Jeremy, to buy Jianying some time, why don't you go
talk
first?
Talk a little bit, okay.
Blah, blah, blah.
She's got one, okay.
I'd like to recommend what we used to call science fiction, but I believe I'm now supposed to call speculative fiction, a book by Kim Stanley Robinson.
Ooh, I love
called
him.
Red Moon. And even if you don't like science fiction, if you're interested in China, the basically I'll give you the setup for it is I can't remember how many years from now, Xi Jinping made a huge success of his nearly lifetime tenure. China is big and powerful. China spent a lot more on the moon than the United States. So it is the biggest, it has the biggest presence on the moon out of any other countries. And the drama takes place between the Earth and the moon. And in America and in China, princelings are plotting a revolution. And it's a lot of fun. And, you know, I'm always hesitant to read books with China stuff written by non-China specialists because of how frequently they get the most, you know, the dumbest things wrong. But he's done a pretty good job of actually giving a sense of contemporary China and of, you know, suggesting a way of thinking about the future. I think that it's interesting for China watchers.
That sounds great. I mean, that's my next book then. I mean, as soon as I read
it's an easy read as well. A lot easier podcast, than most of the books. Yeah. You know, it's.
That's right. Okay, you're up, Jenny. What do you have?
Okay, I'm actually torn between a book and a podcast.
You can do both. You
can do both.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Okay, so let's go with a book first. I would recommend Wang Lixiong. He's
Wozer's husband, right?
Yeah.
The husband of Wozer, right?
Yes, right, that's right. Yeah. Wang Lixiong, who is the author of many books, and including the one on Tibet that I loved 20 years ago, but what I'm recommending is his latest novel. That's actually a political science fiction, you could cast in that category, because it's a novel or a novella, maybe a short novel about casting the future of a China where the Big Brother has reigned all. And it actually is a world of both, you know, the police state and the high-tech police state, where, you know, through like putting something like a chip on everybody's shoe, everybody's every moment, everywhere is under surveillance.
Oh, so he just wrote about Xinjiang again.
Wrote about Tibet, now he's writing about Xinjiang.
Okay. Yeah. This book, I think this came out, this novel maybe came out 2 years ago. But then, you know, something goes wrong in this massively high-tech, you know, state where in the reason that the novel is called Da Dian, Great Ceremony, is this is when it happened. During one of these highly, you know, choreographed, important state ceremony period, assassination took place using the most, you know, unexpected cutting-edge technology by one of these nerdy, you know, designers, you know, geeks, who, because of some kind of mishap for his own interests, got involved in this assassination of the head of the state.
Oh my gosh.
And actually
so
kind
I'm
of got away with it.
This wasn't published in China then.
It was published in Taiwan.
Oh, of course.
And Hong Kong, or maybe Hong Kong, but I read it online and highly recommend. It's very well written and a good read.
Oh, great. What's it called?
There's a love story in it. Yeah, and there's yes, there's a Dadian. There's for geeks. There's a lot of technology,
yeah.
And then there's a sex machine. So it could be almost part of
I'm
it is
sold.
Like a porn.
Sex machine.
Yeah, there's a high tech sex machine.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
That's
so
huge.
There's a like
Jeremy's a high tech sex machine.
so that's one recommendation.
I want that in my next introduction.
Okay. The other is a podcast. I thought this is maybe the time to review some of that Roman history, which is a time of passion and intrigue and strongmen, right? And this is a podcast series by, I hope I don't get his name wrong, Mike Duncan, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easily found on YouTube. It's like 39 episodes, 2 hours each.
Oh my
God. It's very good to listen. Lots of stories. Lots of good storytelling.
And does it cover the entire history of Rome or just the
entire,
the fall?
The history of Rome.
Oh, wow.
It's called. So,
Terrific. Yeah. So, I've always loved these deep dive history podcasts. And yeah. They're lots of fun. I've just got too long of a podcast listening list these days, and I have to produce 7 of them every week, so it's kind of a pain or more. But great recommendations, 2 excellent recommendations. Mine is going to be totally frivolous compared to that, and it's for a band that when you guys are in Beijing, you should definitely make an effort to see. They're called The Spice Cabinet, and they're fronted by a Chinese-American guy who shares a hometown with me. He's from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and his name is Terence Xie. He graduated in jazz trombone performance from Oberlin, which is a very well-known, of course, conservatory. So he's a fantastically gifted musician, tremendously good arranger. The music they play is this, horn-filled, joyous kind of funk pop with lots of jazz in it. They're consummate musicians. They're all just phenomenally good musicians. I mean, the level of musicianship among the Beijing bands, except for, the shitty ones that pretend to be musicians and call themselves experimental or whatever, the level of musicianship's is just phenomenal. And these guys blew me away. I listened to a bunch of their stuff. So make sure to go see them. Music that will make you move. There's just no question. You can't sit still during stuff like this. It's absolutely joyous. So with that, I want to thank you once again. It's such a pleasure to have you back. And let's have you back again soon. Not wait so long this next time.
Yeah, not in another era.
Yeah.
The last time was.
It was a different era. That's
era,
true.
Yeah.
A very, very different
thank
era.
Thank you.
I don't think any of us will be alive by the time this era ends, I'm afraid.
No. On that note, that's really a high note.
Is that a depressing way to end the podcast?
Well, people ask me about the Mike Pence, speech, which is... The all-out call, right, to a Cold War. And my response would be, let's make some frozen daiquiris and toast to the new Cold War.
My response
go
is,
down
fuck that guy.
Without alcohol.
Anyway, thank you for all. Oh, thank you, thanks, Jeremy. A pleasure as always. And thank you all for coming out on Valentine's Day to hang out with us. Yeah.
Thank you.
Stick around and ask some questions, but I'm going to do the outro first. The Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Special thanks this week to the good people at Fordham Law who made this terrific space available to us. Drop us an email at cynica@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out all the other podcasts that we've got, the Taishin Cynical Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, New Voices, China Econ Talk, Ta for Ta, and the brand new Middle Earth Podcast. More great shows coming soon, believe it or not. I got more shows for you guys in store. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.
Yeah, it was good.